Kekav, do you like to start?
Yes. I am in Pondicherry, by the way.
Wonderful.
Yeah. Our explanation of the evolution in matter is that the universe is a self-creative process of a supreme reality whose presence makes spirit the substance of things. All things are there as the spirit's powers and means and form. An infinite existence, an infinite consciousness, an infinite force and will, an infinite delight of being, is the reality secret behind the appearances of the universe. Its divine supermind, or gnosis, has arranged the cosmic order, but arranged it indirectly through the three subordinate and limiting terms of which we are conscious here: mind, life, and matter. The material universe is the lowest stage of a downward plunge of the manifestation, an involution of the manifested being in this triune reality into an apparent nescience of itself, that which we now call the inconscient. But out of this nescience, the evolution of that manifested being into a recovered self-awareness was from the very first inevitable. It was inevitable because that which is involved must evolve. For it is not only there as an existence, a force hidden in its apparent opposite, and every such force must in its inmost nature be moved to find itself, to realize itself, into play. But it is the reality of that which conceals it. It is the self which the nascience has lost, and which, therefore, it must be the whole secret meaning. The constant drift of its action to seek for and recover. It is through the conscious individual being that this recovery is possible. It is in him that the evolving consciousness becomes organized and capable of awaking to its own reality. The immense importance of the individual being, which increases as he rises in the scale, is the most remarkable and significant fact of a universe which started without consciousness and without individuality in an undifferentiated nescience. This importance can only be justified if the self as individual is no less real than the self as cosmic being or spirit, and both are, or cosmic being or spirit, and both are powers of the eternal. It is only so that can be explained the necessity for the growth of the individual and his discovery of himself as a condition for the discovery of the cosmic self and consciousness and of the for the discovery of the cosmic self and consciousness and of the supreme reality. If we adopt this solution, this is the first result: the reality of the persistent individual. But from that first consequence, the other result follows, that rebirth of some kind is no longer a possible machinery which may or may not be accepted, it becomes a necessity, an inevitable outcome of the root nature of our existence.
So, in this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo foregrounds his explanation. And it's a remarkable paragraph because it is bringing full round the entire explanation of the evolution, not merely of consciousness in the cosmos, but the very meaning of rebirth connected to it. Is there a meaning to rebirth? This is the question he's answering, and he's answering it in terms of not some individual causation, not a karma in terms of good and evil, but in terms of the evolution of the cosmos. And the evolution of the cosmos is relating to an original involution and a kind of representation of Supreme Being as an evolving entity. So, the cosmic evolution, which follows a certain kind of a scheme, an order, due to the presence of an intelligence, a supreme and cosmic intelligence, the supermind or gnosis, which arranges this cosmic order, as he says, but arranges it indirectly, and because it arranges it indirectly, because it arranges it through a certain kind of self-creative process given to the earth, given to the material cosmos, rather, it takes on the appearance of an ignorance and a chance and a emergence through chance. A precarious emergence, which can at any moment dissolve back into the unformed seed of the cosmos, and perhaps does so dissolve a number of times. But this leads to the notion of the rebirth of the cosmos. Perhaps the cosmos is also being reborn in its persistence to give a final form to the evolution of consciousness in the ignorance. But it cannot assume its conscious form until the appearance of the human individual. And that's the remarkable, as he says over here, fact of the universe. It's remarkable. He calls it the most remarkable and significant fact of a universe which started without consciousness and without individuality in an undifferentiated nescience. And he's drawing us to recognize is this remarkable nature, because the world presents a face to us which is already given. And what is important or remarkable in it is not evident to us until it is pointed out to us. And this is what he's doing here. He's bringing to our attention this drift that the appearance of the individual is so significant in this undifferentiated and nascent universe gradually growing into consciousness. Because the individual carries in itself the entire potentiality of the cosmos to evolve in a conscious manner as an individual will. This is why the individual represents the marriage of Purusha and Prakriti. This is the real reason why the automatic processes of Prakriti are not sufficient to bring about the manifestation of divine consciousness. The divine itself must find a form. The conscious being must find a form, an individualized form, in which it can take up the reins of approximation, that cosmic nature has been evolving and push it towards its own masterful manifestation. That is the remarkable and significant place of the individual, and he makes a startling leap from there to posit the fact that therefore there must be three realities that coexist in importance and are equal in primacy in terms of the manifestation of the divine. Each one of them is an equal representation or presentation, one may say, of the supreme reality. These are spirit, cosmos, and the individual. So individual is not a product of the cosmos. Individual cannot be dissolved into any kind of other substratum, whether mental, vital, or even spiritual, as the monistic point of view tries to present. But individual persists, is present in its latency from the very beginning, and after it appears, cannot disappear except through a series of rebirths, ending up in the full presentation of its reality as an immortal conscious face of the Supreme Being. This, in fact, is, one may say, a theistic presentation that Sri Aurobindo gives us, because it assumes that the divine reality is a person, is an individual, is a Purushottama, who enters as Purusha into every individual. And therefore, the whole meaning of the evolution is the self-multiplication of Purushottama as a divine play, Leela, in a manifest consciousness. To arrive at that point, rebirth becomes the mechanism.
Debashista, when does individuality start? Does it start with the human body?
Individuality, differentiation starts with material entities. But individuality starts with the appearance of the psychic being. And psychic being is the soul personality, because psychic being, individuality and psychic being are very closely related. Not the soul entity, but the soul personality. They are related because psychic being as soul personality is the marriage of Purusha and Prakriti. It contains in itself both Ishvara and Shakti. Purushottama and Paraprakriti in union are manifested or represented as psychic being, in quintessence, in an individualized form. That's why in terms of the nature it is said, the psychic being is the self-representation of Paraprakriti, individuation of Paraprakriti, Paraprakriti Jiva Bhuta. But in terms of Purusha, it is Chaitya Purusha. So it is that which becomes the person. It is not just an Atma, not just a self, but a person that is the center of individuation. And it is only when that appears that individuality can be said to appear. And that appears, interestingly, only with the appearance of mind in the cosmos. Again, a very interesting side note through, again, my conversations with Kirit Joshi. He said that the mother told him that the psychic being actually appears a little before the appearance of mind in the cosmos. The possibility of psychic being appears a little before after the Annamaya Purusha and Pranamaya Purusha are established, and before the appearance of mind, psychic being makes its appearance.
Would you mind just interpreting very briefly the Annamaya Purusha and the two Purushas that you mentioned?
Yes. This this has to do with the involution and the individuation of the cosmos. The involution of spirit in matter results in prakriti. It's actually what is sometimes called the holocaust of Purusha, or the sacrifice of the Purusha, is this becoming of matter, subjection to the inconscient, subjection to forgetting that divine spirit undergoes in matter. But that is really the subjection of the prakriti. The prakriti ties herself into the laws of inconscience. Now, the Purusha plunges himself into that bound condition and becomes completely immersed in the works of prakriti. Purusha is lost in prakriti, in the earth. That is the beginning of the journey of Purusha, and in the beginning, that immersed condition, that samadhi in matter, in anna, in the physical reality, is the beginnings of the Annamaya Purusha. Life is generated and the Purusha awakes a little bit, and yet it is bound by the processes of life, and that is the emergence of the Pranamaya Purusha. Now, when mind is generated and the human beings emerge, then that Purusha emerges even more in nature, becomes a little more master of nature, though still ruled by her laws, and that is Manomaya Purusha. Now, in the human individual, these three projections exist in an individualized form. Each of us has an Annamaya Purusha, Pranamaya Purusha, and Manomaya Purusha. Annamaya Purusha is connected with or closely locked in our body. Pranamaya Purusha in our vital functions, and the Manomaya Purusha with the mind. Most of the yogas that have attempted to release Purusha from prakriti have focused on Manomaya Purusha, because that already has a certain degree of freedom. Through asanas and hatha yogic processes, through pranayama, Annamaya and Pranamaya Purusha can be to some extent released from their bondage to prakriti. But the real command or control of all these three Purushas is in the hands of the psychic being. Psychic being can, in its emergence, call the power of Purusha in mind, life and matter into its full mastery.
Just a sidetrack question. Indispensable it is to do this kind of hatha yoga and all that in order to release that Annamaya Purusha. Like, is it possible to have an alternative way to go through the entire psychic, only psychic being, and let the psychic being do the things, or this hatha yoga and asanas are indispensable?
In Sri Aurobindo's viewpoint, they are not indispensable, but they are helpful. Now, not only asanas, but any kind of physical exercise is helpful as a subsidiary process of the emergence of the psychic being. So, psychic being, that's why in his teaching, the primary movement is neither asanas, nor pranayama, nor even meditation. All these three movements become important but subsidiary movements. The primary movement becomes one of the focusing of the aspiration in the center of the heart to kindle the flame within, as he says, of the person, arriving at the center of the person, kindling the flame and establishing a direct and constant link with the Supreme Divine above. That link, which is a dynamic exchange between the individual and the Supreme, between Chaitya Purusha and individualized prakriti of the psychic being, and the Ishvara Shakti above becomes the way by which the psychic being emerges to the front and starts controlling mind, life and vital. But in this process, all three other kinds of means, the means of the physical, to become more supple, to become more conscious, to you know, arrive at mastery of itself, can and should, in fact, be generated as a process within this movement of the psychic. So, as we see in Sri Aurobindo's own case with his Sapta Chatushta, Sharira Chatushta forms a very important part. And that can be done whether through asanas or through a more conscious use of even conventional exercises, putting the attention, as it were, of the psychic process into the physical movements. In doing this, the Annamaya Purusha not only becomes released, but the Annamaya Prakriti becomes psychicized. That is more the goal than just release of the Annamaya Purusha. So, but the age-old exercises of asanas and pranayama and different forms of meditation are very, very valuable because they have so much science that has gone into them, and therefore they can be very well utilized as a powerful means to collaborate with this psychic emergence.
May I ask a slightly unrelated question? Actually, I just recently heard that when Sri Aurobindo was in the process of leaving his body, right before that, Mother and Sri Aurobindo had like constantly looking at each other for a long time. And then Sri Aurobindo asked her to leave because otherwise he couldn't leave his body. So, and then when Mother, you know, exited from that room, he almost immediately left his body. So, which part, I mean, of course, her body was not as strongly present when she exited compared to when she was there. But is that body the main tool to prevent death from taking or death or whatever, you know? Can you explain a little bit like what this physical presence's role to you know, not to let Sri Aurobindo leaving leave his body?
Yeah, actually you're right, it is the physical presence. And in a sense, the mother very powerfully moved the entire yoga into the body after Sri Aurobindo's departure. And in fact, she has a statement saying, "You understand nothing unless the body understands it." You know, this tremendous focus on the body was because ultimately the goal of the yoga is the transformation of the physical, of matter. And that is the phase into which she moved it. Of course, in our case, this may not be exactly the point because a long journey awaits before that. But in their case, that had become the point, and there was a stability of the higher being, of the fullness of the supramental being in the higher planes, and an entry of that into the body. Now, Sri Aurobindo has said that the special opportunity given by the mother's presence as a physical being is that her physical being manifests and transmits the divine energies, whether the overmental or the supramental energies. Now, that she does physically, that is through her look, through her touch. And therefore, this control of the prakritic mechanisms of matter are closely connected with the presence of the conscious being of the supramental Purusha in control of matter. It is actually only the supramental Purusha that can prevent death. None of the other Purushas can. So the mother's highest Shakti could keep Sri Aurobindo's body intact, because it is that power in him himself that it could invoke. This is one way of thinking about it. But when the physical withdrew, perhaps you know, Sri Aurobindo's will, many people feel it, of course it is his, even the description you gave, it is his will to leave, because he wouldn't leave until she was there. But when she left, he chose to leave. So his will to leave, in some sense, is totally united or tied to the physical presence of the Purusha in the mother. And that's the reason why her physical absence allowed that will to operate independently.
So that way, when she actually exited in 1973, then it was gone, right?
Well, many people feel that nothing left when she left. It was, she often starts calling it the residue. In George's treatment of this matter in the book, The Mother, you'll find that he draws on a lot of evidence to point to the fact that she had actually moved into the supramental body completely. So that what she left behind was really what she keeps calling the residue. She says it is the, you know, paper thin residue which still has not been transformed, and that awaits cosmic transformation. It cannot be transformed, but most of the physical consciousness has been drawn into what she called the true body. That term, the true body, she actually describes elsewhere as the subtle physical body, which has complete, where the Purusha has complete control over the Annamaya Prakriti.
So, is it like this, that the way she was looking at Sri Aurobindo on that, on 5th December, that way now she is looking at everyone at all times?
That's a beautiful way of putting it. And indeed, she can do that. And exactly, she is invoking for the entire creation that possibility, because only that way that we can all move into that cosmic realization that is necessary for her supramental body to become active.
Debashisna, I have heard a kind of bias, or maybe it's not a bias. It's that people think that some people in Auroville who have been reading the agenda more than reading other books of Sri Aurobindo and Mother have a leaning towards working on their bodies before they have purified their mind and vital, whereas the other bias thinks that the body is the last thing to touch, and the conduit should be through the mind, which is most conscious, and then the vital being, and then the body. So there is always this kind of sort of condescension from one camp towards the other. So is there any basis of this at all?
Yes, there is something like that. There is a certain kind of difference of opinion of that kind that has emerged. But as I was saying, the mother towards the end of her life did focus almost entirely on the body, and she did give a tremendous emphasis to body. Now, to yoga and the body. Now, while Sri Aurobindo and the mother were in their bodies, every movement that they through themselves became extremely powerfully mirrored in the yoga of those who were around them. And therefore, at that time, there was a tremendous focus on the body that took place. Now, whether that means that now that entire yoga has to be first achieved through concentration first on the body, or through the emergence of the psychic being and all the triple transformation, as Sri Aurobindo sort of points out, is a question mark. Now, the triple transformation, the emergence of the psychic being is 100% necessity. You know, nothing can be done in the body until that's part of our discussion from the very beginning of three purushas. The Annamaya Purusha in and by itself is not there to achieve the supramental transformation. It is as a aspect of the psychic being that it achieves it. So that's the reason why there is a certain kind of mistake if people feel that the psychic being can be bypassed in focusing on the transformation of the body. The body cannot be transformed until and unless there is a sufficient degree of progress in the more basic aspects of the yoga. It is when a certain critical amount of advance has been made that one can talk of focus on the body. But all that said, ultimately yoga is something totally individualized and inexplicable. And one thing that I remember, which I kind of say to myself again and again from what Dr. Maheshwari used to tell me, is that if it works for you, it's okay. If it doesn't work for you, drop it. So if it works for somebody, you know, they should go with it because it's an uncharted territory. There are no laws here. There is only, as Sri Aurobindo said, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, he used to say.
Yeah, it's very nice. And Mother also has said many times that do your yoga, don't look at what the others are doing.
Exactly. Mysterious things have happened, no doubt. You know, things have changed in terms of priorities and emphasis since 1956 and maybe continuously since then. The mother has said at one place, you know, to a question as to whether one needed to ascend, understand and ascend through all the planes of mind up to the supermind and then bring down the supermind in each of our cases. And she has said, no, that is no longer necessary, though that will automatically happen as part of the process. But now with the supramental consciousness operating on the earth, it is a cosmic presence. And therefore, one does not need to travel all the way up there to contact it. It is already here. And it can start acting on our various sheets if we know how to open ourselves to it through receptivity, even before we arrive at a kind of overmental and supramental transcendence of the mind. But even there, one has to realize that receptivity is not a kind of a given, you know, to ignorant humanity. It has to, even receptivity has to be achieved as a psychic quality.
Debashita, is it completely random that the psychic being is encased in the human body? I mean, suppose nature would sort of abandon this path of her evolution and create a different kind of being, non-human. It was time for the psychic being to come and it would encase itself in that body. Can we speculate that way, or it is just a futile speculation at all?
What kind, you mean alternate to the human at the same time of evolution? Are you talking about
Let's say it is
hominids of different kinds before Homo sapiens appeared?
Yeah, or not even human, let's say another kind of animal body or a bird body or a reptile body that exists when the psychic being can come on Earth and it just houses itself there.
You remember that very interesting passage in the Aitiriya Upanishad where Prajapati marshals all the beings before the gods,
yeah,
and
only
when the human being comes, the gods say, this is truly well fashioned. Now, the reason for that, you know, the Bible has a line where it says that man is made in the image of God. Now, these seem to be kind of, you know, very hubristic statements, just glorifying the human being above all other creatures. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of fact, the occult or esoteric significance of it is that the prakritic mechanisms in the human being make it potentially possible to embody the Purushottama. That we have just sufficient amount of prakritic approximation that can open itself to a transformation that will embody the Purushottama. That's the reason why a human being is made in the image of God. It's not that we are already there, but we have the latency of the occult mechanism by which that can be manifest. And the first thing in that is a well-formed mental instrument, a well-formed prakritic mental instrument, not merely the brain, but the inner mind, the occult foundations of mind in matter. So as a result, human being, you see, that's why the psychic being makes its emergence with the appearance of human-like creatures, perhaps hominids, even before Homo sapiens. And it becomes fully formed in the human being.
Can it be said that actually always we did about these three, you know, subordinate terms, mind, life, and matter. And a human being is the first species where the mind got its own domain properly. Or that is not true. I mean, can you correct me if I'm wrong?
Yeah. No, absolutely. It is without a doubt true. That's the reason why psychic being makes its appearance. Human being is the first being in whom mind got its domain properly. It's absolutely true. That's the reason why, in fact, the appearance of the psychic being is closely tied to the appearance of mental principle in Prakriti, in the human being. So both as a cosmic manifestation and as an appearance of individuality, human being is the first.
But it's not necessarily the last, right?
It's definitely not necessarily the last. And interestingly, there could have been other possibilities as well. I mean, we are talking about, again, this is when we look at the tree of evolution in Darwinian terms, there also there is an assumption. Darwinian evolution assumes that branches sort of, you know, narrow down. Branches don't kind of, you don't have a tree with innumerable branches at the same level. They keep narrowing down. Now, that assumption they may claim is based on natural selection. In other words, what survives is narrow. Only few things survive. But still, even there is a certain kind of occult process that may be intuited. That there is a way by which perfection is being aimed in the prakritic equipment that will most suitably embody the Purushottama, the individuality of cosmic being. So when you say that human being may not be the last, indeed it's not the last. Again, that's the reason why you can talk about a certain pride of arrogance in human beings considering themselves to be the acme of natural creation. And even to say that we are made in the image of God, we are made potentially in the image of God. It is a possibility within the human instruments. But to realize that possibility is a long shot, it's not easy. That's the reason why Mother says that the distance between man and Superman is more than the distance between animal and man.
So by that notion, it could be that man is actually kind of, you know, like a local maxima.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a local maxima, but it is not a fixed maxima. That is, it has possibilities of evolution into something higher. But again, that begs the whole question of whether man is just an intermediate species.
Actually, when I was saying that it's not necessarily the last, what I mean is that before Superman, meaning between man and Superman, there could be other species as well. Is that true?
Yes, there could be. There could be. Only thing is that the thing is that if we look at natural processes, then if it is a process that is not a kind of a sudden eruption, you know, like a miracle, that another, you know, like a descent of another species without preparation into the Earth atmosphere, which is also possible because ultimately supramental manifestation is through control of matter. Now, if it is not to be that, but to be a continuation of the present process, and a narrowing of the branch of the tree that has led up to man, then it can only be a bifurcation in the human. It couldn't be that some other hominid, like some other kind of ape, will emerge at an intermediate species between man and Superman, because it wouldn't have been able to go through the intermediate processes. But it could happen automatically, that is, a sudden appearance by miracle. That what creationism is all about. Creationism is not impossible at the higher rungs of the evolution, because as nature comes closer and closer to affirming the truth of supermind, supermind may intervene in its own way. But at the same time, so Mother has actually said that, the possibilities of the human should not be called the arrival at Superman. It should not be called the arrival at the supramental being. It should be called the arrival at the Superman, which George has even further, split hairs and called it the overman. He says, don't talk about Superman arising from the human being. The maximum we are capable of is what Mother called the overman, Suron. But the supramental being is one step further.
What I was trying to say, I guess, was the exact contrast of what Keka was saying, which was that I was thinking that just like between man and Superman, what Keka was saying about some intermediary, I was thinking more that there might even have to be a dip before the next rise.
Now that also Mother has talked about, because if the human being is to evolve the Superman out of itself, then very well it may be through a kind of a bifurcation and a speciation leap. So that kind of thing, which nature has seen in other evolutionary leaps, is very possible. Mother has said that the human being may move into a certain stage where a number of evolutionary possibilities open up in front of it, and what we call the human be truly realized as only a kind of a fluctuating possibility, not a kind of a stable possibility. So there she is talking about a sub-mental life also possibly emerging from the human. She's saying the bifurcation may be such that a kind of a whole section of humanity devolves into a subhuman species just as another section evolves into a superhuman species.
So the Vashistha Rishi also talk of the reasons why it may be necessary. Whether is it just because of, is it only because of the play of the possibilities, or because the humans, the human behavior results in such a kind of bifurcation over time, like different parts of the species, I mean, different populace of the species behave in different ways, and as a result, and as a result of that, I mean, to loosely use the word karma, it results in that bifurcation.
No, from what this is actually entering into a little bit of a speculative domain.
Sorry.
From what I understand, what she's saying is that human choice, I mean, ultimately, what differentiates this creation from any other creation of the divine is the appearance of choice within it. It's constantly marked by will. Of ignorance. Ignorance has the will to choose either to remain ignorant or to accept the knowledge. So choice operating at this very crucial white seat point of evolution with the supramental present in it can yield a tremendously powerful matrix of possibilities where bifurcations can take place. She has spoken about the fact that this supramental catalyst can actually catalyze change. It's like some people say, you know, be careful what you wish for because it may come true. So it is in that sense that will in today's world can really catalyze by the supramental power possibilities that are unforeseen, though there is also, one may say, a directing force, a guiding force towards the Superman. But before that becomes a clear possibility, we are living right now in a kind of intermediate zone. And that intermediate zone is peopled by many kinds of alternate possibilities. What, you know, my friend Rich Carlson calls post-human destinies. There's a variety of alternate post-human destinies that are beckoning us at this point. And perhaps a number of them will emerge, and how many of them will remain is a matter of conjecture. But that is the nature of choice in a charged supramental matrix.
Thank you, Devashish.
So, when the Superman arrives, there would not be any need for rebirth?
Yes, very good question. You know, we go back to that statement that I love to quote from the first chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga, where he says that the condition of a material immortality is to be perpetually reborn in time. Now, the condition of a physical immortality, that is what the supramental body will be. It is not a fixed body. It is a body that is consciously being reborn. We are also part of the same process, but rebirth is a compulsion for us. We have to accept the mechanism of death and rebirth. A supramental body will consciously rebirth itself. This is the difference. It's not that it will not be reborn. That is a mistaken understanding of the perpetuation of immortality in the supramental body.
So, just like material immortality, are there the other immortalities for the vital and the spirit aspect as well?
Yes, of course, there is. Those can be relatively earlier achieved. And many yogis there are who achieve that. And that's why they persist immortally in astral forms. Christ or a Buddha is still around and will be around as long as it wishes to be around by choice. That's partly because some immortal principle, whether it be a higher immortal principle or it be the psychic being, has absorbed a certain amount of the nature into itself. So the sheaths of inner mind, inner vital and inner physical, to the degree that they become part of the divine personality with some divine immortal principle at its center, will achieve physical, mental, vital and subtle physical immortality, and has in many cases. It is the physical and the life on earth that is denied that particular possibility, so long as the permeation of the immortal principle is not sufficient here.
Going back to our original paragraph, it hinges upon evolution. So, what is the influence of the other immortalities on the evolution of the cosmos itself? What is its impact?
You mean the other immortalities, mean of the mental, vital, etc.?
Yes.
Even those other immortalities, Sita, is not available until and unless the psychic being actually emerges in the individual. So these are also stages. And to answer your question more accurately about what is its impact on the cosmic evolution, it is only in beings who are far ahead of the race, the yogis and rishis and avatars, that it can be achieved to some degree. So then they can remain as an influence. This is really the way in which you see nature acts. He talks about it in synthesis, that nature always overshoots herself. Always she throws out possibilities much in advance of what she has achieved. The future is living among us, because there are beings like that who have appeared, and in a symbolic form they are like the stars. Night is the symbol of ignorance, and the stars are the, you know, innumerable forerunners who remain in the ignorance to shed light upon it. And in the light of those stars, and in the map that they have created in the ignorance, the map of the constellations, we can guide ourselves towards the new day. So that is really the influence they have on the cosmos.
That was beautiful. Just couldn't help saying that.
Yeah, that map and the constellation sky is a very beautiful image. So Sri Aurobindo is also there somewhere. I mean, I've heard some people say that Mother said he is in the subtle physical. I believe it is different from the astral planes.
Oh yeah, she says he has a permanent home in the subtle physical, and we can go there whenever we want. But also in another place, you know, this beautiful question answer where somebody asks the mother, "Mother, where is Sri Aurobindo now?" And the mother's answer is, "He can be wherever he wants to be because he is absolutely free." This is the fact, that really he can be wherever he wants to be, because, you know, even in terms of physical, as the mother says, Sri Aurobindo said, "I will return in the first physical supramental body built in the supramental way." He could, if he wished, assume material form right here and now, but it is his will.
Well, this is actually not in topic, but slightly different. I have heard that there was a doctor in the ashram called Dr. Hazari, who had seen a vision of Sri Aurobindo dictating a certain epic to him, and he calls the epic Devayana. Have you heard of such an incident?
No, I have not heard of the incident, but I have somebody in Northern California sort of sent me a link to this Devayana site. Yes, I've noticed it, but you see, the thing is, I have to say that this could be explained in innumerable ways, because one cannot really know what the source of that inspiration and vision is. Sri Aurobindo can come to us on many planes, and it may be he or various subtle representations or even distortions of him. So it is not really clear what it is. Again, the same thing applies. If it helps, one must use it. If it doesn't, one must drop it. Only thing one can say for sure is that Sri Aurobindo himself wrote Savitri. That there is no doubt that there is that same being that we know as Sri Aurobindo. Nobody dictated it. He himself dictated it to Nirodha. But that's the one sure anchor of something divine that has been left behind.
Lopa,
yeah.
Take the next.
Is it starting with that birth then is a necessity?
Yes.
No, for it is no longer sufficient.
For it is no longer sufficient to suppose.
For it is no longer sufficient to suppose an illusory or temporary individual created in each form by the play of consciousness. Individuality can no longer be conceived as an accompaniment of play of consciousness in figure of body which may or may not survive the form, may or may not prolong its false continuity of self from form to form, from life to life, but which certainly need not do it. In this world, what we seem at first to see is individual replacing individual without any continuity, the form dissolving, the false or transient individuality dissolving with it, while the universal energy or some universal being alone remains forever. That might very well be the whole principle of cosmic manifestation. But if the individual is a persistent reality, an eternal portion or power of the eternal, if his growth of consciousness is the means by which the spirit in things discloses its being, the cosmos reveals itself as a conditioned manifestation of the play of the eternal one in the being of Satchidananda with the eternal many. Then, secure behind all the changings of our personality, upholding the stream of its mutations, there must be a true person, a real spiritual individual, a true Purusha. The one extended in universality exists in each being and affirms himself in this individuality of himself. In the individual, he discloses his total existence by oneness with all in the universality. In the individual, he discloses too his transcendence as the eternal in whom all the universal unity is founded. This trinity of self-manifestation, this prodigious leela of the manifold identity, this magic of Maya, or protean miracle of the conscious truth of being of the infinite, is the luminous revelation which emerges by a slow evolution from the original in conscience.
it is so beautiful. So here we see he is trying to give voice to that ultimate mystery of this creation, that it is a supreme Purusha who, for the play of the one with the many, has marshaled this evolution out of the ignorance. That is transcendent, that creates the field of the play, the kshetra, as the universal, that is the knower of the field, that enters into the individual as the individualized form of the many. So in the individual, it knows itself as all three. Its infinite possibilities are marshaled into a play of infinity. Each individual is the entire infinite. So this is the way in which infinity multiplies itself to know itself infinitely. One being knowing its own infinite powers as a dynamized play by the power of the dynamic principle. That is why he calls it the magic of Maya, this magic of Maya. The earlier part of the paragraph, he points out how this understanding of the meaning of rebirth makes it a necessity. Again, we go back to our questioning earlier as to whether it has to be a necessity. He's pointing out that this coherence, this, you know, sort of integral understanding of the meaning of the universe, of the cosmos, of the individual, of rebirth, of the transcendent, is something which is so full of integrality, so with us in all things around us, that it's not a kind of an alien theory, but something which almost one feels must be. It is natural. It is what is the drift of things all around us. It's like the Eureka of Archimedes. Mm-hmm. It is a self-evident truth. And that's all. It's all that he's doing is kind of just laying it out. That this is, look at it. This is what it is all around you.
What is the true individuality? What is not Maya is true individuality. Can you define it that way?
Where is it, Sita?
No, like, see the, all around what is happening is forms dissolving, the false extent,
yes,
individuality dissolving with it. So,
yes.
So, that which is beyond Maya, basically which is not changing, is the,
yes,
the, pretty much by negation of that statement, you should understand the what is.
That is one way of understanding it, true. That is one way of understanding it. The other one is to look at it as the truth of individuality. The truth of individuality is the true individual. The true individual is the individual who is the embodiment of truth. In other words, it is Purushottama. Purushottama is true individuality. There is only one person. The only problem is that it is an infinite person. That's why he shows himself in that way to Arjuna in the Vishwarupa as the infinite person. That infinite person is in every person.
Debashista, there is one phrase here. I'm reading, it's towards the middle of the paragraph. But if the individual is a persistent reality, an eternal portion or power of the eternal, if his growth of consciousness is the means by which the spirit in things discloses its being, the cosmos reveals itself as a conditioned manifestation of the play of the eternal one in the being of Satchidananda with the eternal many. So this thing about the cosmos reveals itself, that's as a result. That's how he has structured the sentence.
The appearance of the individual. But in the meantime, as he's saying, the whole evolutionary process is a process of the self-manifestation of the Supreme. So out of an ignorance into a knowledge, the entire cosmos is the cosmic body of the Supreme Being. It's the in that sense, it is a representation of the One with all its infinity latent in it, its infinite possibility latent in it. It is with the appearance of individuality that its infinities become manifest in the representation. So cosmos is also a being. The whole cosmos is an evolving being. But it cannot become a conscious being with the will to manifest until within it its infinite possibilities arise as conscious portions that urge it forward. In other words, cosmic prakriti lays the ground for the appearance of that which will redeem cosmic prakriti itself. It can go so far as to release the possibility of individuality. But then individuality must take the next step to redeem cosmos or to
Shall we resume? The Vishishta, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
So you were saying something and in the middle it dropped.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I was saying that the cosmos can go so far as to, cosmos is a representation of the Supreme Being which has the prakritic element in it. In other words, it is the prakriti without individualized purusha. So cosmos can go so far as to release, it is the one being with the infinity latent within it. It can go so far as to release individuality as the infinite conscious portions. And at that point, individuality has to turn back and take cosmos with it. That is, perfection of the individual perfects humanity as well as the cosmos.
So can you say that the experience or the history before the human beings arrived, that experience is latent in every individual, just like it is latent according to Darwinian theory, as the experience, so that we don't say that time is lost, meaning if the experience is not stored somewhere, it's lost, right? Like,
absolutely right, quite true. In human consciousness, because ultimately cosmos also is a structure of consciousness. It is the being that persists in matter. It is immersed in matter, immersion of consciousness in matter. So in the human being too, this entire history, as you put it, of the emergence of consciousness is kept as a form of memory. We have in our Annamaya Purusha the record of the memory of the evolution of matter up to its form in the human. So too in the Pranamaya Purusha, we have the record of the memory of the entire evolution of life and life forms. And in the Prakriti, of course, we have a certain kind of form which has already evolved but contains within it, like you said, in Darwinian theory, the record of its past. So both in the Purusha and the Prakriti, this memory is stored. In the Purusha in a conscious form, in the Prakriti in a sedimented form. So that is the difference. But certainly there is no loss in that sense. Mother has said, in fact, that a full knowledge of the history of the earth is part of the supramental knowledge. So in each individual, there will arise, just as with the true knowledge of the psychic being, there is a knowledge of our past births. See, the knower of the past births, Jata Veda, Agni Jata Veda. Veda called, the Veda has named Agni as the knower of births, Jata Veda. That is because the psychic flame within us knows all its births. You see, the memory of all the entire births is contained there. But these are the births of individuality. As you point out, the cosmic history prior to the emergence of individuality is also locked in the instruments, in the physical, vital and mental instruments. And the inner mind, inner vital, inner physical, which is much more directly under the influence of the Purushas of these planes, is able to recover these histories. So, depending on the kind of awakening, a variety of things of this kind may come to us. Even one may develop the power of knowing the history of a certain place just by sitting there or by coming into contact with it. So even these powers are related to the fact that the history of consciousness is latent in all of us. Psychic entity also has taken a certain kind of a trajectory, though we may not know the exact detail of what we might have been before the human individuality appeared. Still, the conditions of consciousness are latent within us.
So the psychic being comes from a different plane, right? Like it comes and takes a manifest in the cosmos, and after that it sort of has an exchange with the cosmic being for these history, or how does it how does the psychic being catch up?
Well, psychic being is ultimately a formation of the psychic entity. Psychic entity has entered from the very beginning. From the time that there is matter on earth, psychic entity has been present. So psychic entity and psychic being, they have a certain relationship. We can draw on the memory of the psychic entity to know what has happened in the past, and gradually that becomes available to us, because psychic entity is related to Annamaya Pranamaya and Manomaya Purusha, as we discussed earlier. So it is these Purushas that have always been there, from the beginning of this material manifestation. Our souls, in a sense, may have appeared at a certain point of time, but the possibility of the soul's appearance has been overseen by a certain kind of latency of conscious being within matter from the beginning of its appearance.
Thank you, that helps a lot.
You see, a similar process Sri Aurobindo talks about with regard to avatarhood. The avatar appears at a certain point in time. Of course, we may say that the avatar is the supreme being, the transcendental being, so in a way it can know anything and everything. But in a more intimate way, it knows about the history of the ignorance, because it oversees or it connects itself to an evolving soul in the ignorance. So it chooses from before, it borrows, one may say, a lineage, a psychic lineage to connect itself to. Sri Aurobindo, for example, with Leonardo da Vinci, that particular soul and its journey from its past through other souls into the future has been overseen, has been guided, as it were, has been looked at from above, from its own plane, by the avatar being, by the Purushottama. And it is when its own time comes that it associates itself materially with that. Similarly, the psychic being and the psychic entity have a similar relationship.
Shall we read the next one?
Okay.
George, would you like to read?
I think George probably doesn't have a mic. I tried contacting him earlier. I figured he may not have a mic.
Oh, okay. Maybe I will.
He's not to respond to you.
Okay.
It is like talking to the Annamaya Purusha.
I'll read. If there were no need of self-finding, but only an eternal enjoyment of this play of the being of Sachidananda, and such an eternal enjoyment is the nature of certain supreme states of conscious existence, then evolution and rebirth need not have come into operation. But there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference phenomenal, because the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. This play of difference has found its utmost term of the sense of division by the precipitation of the dividing mind into a form of body in which it becomes conscious of itself as a separate ego. A dense and solid basis has been laid for this play of division in a world of separative forms of matter by an involution of the active self-consciousness of Satchidananda into a phenomenal nations. It is this foundation of nescience that makes the division secure, because it imperatively opposes a return to the consciousness of unity. But still, though effectively obstructive, it is phenomenal and terminable, because within it, above it, supporting it, is the all-conscient spirit, and the apparent nations turns out to be only a concentration, an exclusive action of consciousness transed into self-forgetfulness by an abysmal plunge into the absorption of the formative and creative material process. In a phenomenal universe so created, the separative form becomes the foundation and the starting point of all its life action. Therefore, the individual Purusha, in working out its cosmic relations with the one, has in this physical world to base himself upon the form, to assume a body. It is the body that he must make his own foundation and the starting point for his development of life and mind and spirit in the physical existence. That assumption of body we call birth, and in it only can take place here the development of self and the play of relations between the individual and the universal and all other individuals. In it only can there be the growth by progressive development of our conscious being towards a supreme recovery of unity with God and with all in God. All the sum of what we call life in the physical world is a progress of a soul and proceeds by birth into the body and has that for its fulcrum, its condition of action and its condition of evolutionary persistence.
So, in this again beautiful passage, Sri Aurobindo has gone one step further in telling us how this evolving Leela is fashioning itself. But we must also realize that there are a variety of subtexts to Sri Aurobindo's text. One of them is his relationship with the Indian tradition. At this point, if you come to this particular paragraph, by the time we come to it, let's say in the previous paragraph, he has already considered many different theories of rebirth, proposed his own, and as it were put to a side a variety of philosophical possibilities that exist in the Indian tradition as well. In the paragraph preceding this, he has hinted at a prioritization of Vaishnavism. That is, throughout that previous paragraph, the stamp of Sri Aurobindo's integral Vaishnavism. In this paragraph, he begins by drawing his difference from the traditional schools of Vaishnavism. That's how he begins it, because in traditional Vaishnavism, there is a Leela, but the Leela is not an evolving Leela. It is either eternally veiled in the avidya, or it is eternally unveiled in a divine world, a supraphysical world of the divine. So, here he is pointing out to the fact that this is the world of Leela. And this is how it happens. One doesn't have to go to some supraphysical world, however supreme that state may be. If there was no need of self-finding, but only an eternal enjoyment of this play of the being of Satchidananda. In other words, that's where he's pointing to the lack in the traditional Vaishnava theories. There it is Leela only. There is no explanation given to the stress of labor and struggle and the delight in knowledge that this creation has at its base. Why is it that there is such a sense of trying to emerge and know what is the reality of things, what is the truth of things? Why is there such a sense of labor, the very inner meaning of work in this universe? And if that was not there, then one could say that it is all without any meaning. The real meaning is the play of the being of Satchidananda. And in that case, earthly existence and all its search and seeking and trouble would be castigated as a kind of illusion or a veiled reality arbitrarily thrust upon it by some divine as a means of some kind of enjoyment that is inscrutable and only experienced by us as a kind of sadism, perhaps. So he says, if there were no need of self-finding, then such and such an eternal enjoyment is the nature of certain supreme states of conscious existence. Here he is talking about supraphysical experiences of the unveiled reality of Leela. But then he points to the fact that no, this explanation that he has given would cast within this world of self-finding this other reality of the play of delight. Then evolution and rebirth need not have come into operation, if that was all it is. But if we are to explain evolution and rebirth and the self-finding of the divine, or in terms of the self-finding of the divine, then the explanation he has given becomes just and necessary. So that's why he says, but there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind. And it is from this point on that he is giving us the mechanism of how this process has occurred, how the involution has occurred, and how the evolution must occur in response. And this description that has been read is also very dense, because in a way he is reformulating in this language what he has elsewhere called the operation of the overmind Maya. And even elsewhere called the lapse of the prajnana. So if we look at it over here, this one sentence, but there has been an involution of this unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference phenomenal, because the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind, comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. Now this sentence sums it all. This is what is the lapse of the prajnana. Prajnana is that power of supermind whereby the real unity in difference remains unabridged behind. That casts a veil upon its oneness and begins operating as the overmind Maya. That is when there is an involution of the unity into the dividing mind, a plunge into self-oblivion by which the ever-present sense of the complete oneness is lost, and the play of separative difference comes into the forefront as a dominant reality. So this is the mechanism, the beginning of the mechanism. Now this deliberate fragmentation of the one into the many, this dismemberment of the one body of God is another description of the sacrifice. This is the sacrifice where the one cuts himself into all his limbs and all these limbs fall to the earth. Now this process cannot stop into at a level of mind. Mind must cast itself into form of matter. Ultimately, it must cast itself into its absolute, separative, determined reality. That's why he's saying over here, this play of difference has found its utmost term, because once it has taken that move to immerse itself in its individualized, fragmented forms, it must find its ultimate fragmented form. So its utmost term, this play of difference has found its utmost term of the sense of division by the precipitation of the dividing mind into a form of body in which it becomes conscious of itself as a separate ego. Jiva assumes physical form. See, that is the separate ego. This assumption of physical form is the immersion of consciousness in matter. Matter as the dividing appearance of Brahman, in which consciousness is latent only. It is not at all expressed. So that allows differentiation to complete itself in its utmost term. It is that which becomes the foundation in nescience. And that has to be assumed by soul if it is to know its truth as individuality in a play of the many or of the one in the many. The one transcendental, what he has described so far is the cosmic process. This is how cosmos becomes formed. Within this cosmos, the one must plunge itself into each one of these differentiated forms of bodies as the psychic entity and the psychic being. In this plunge, it becomes differentiated individually. So the one individual becomes the multiple individuals that will form the basis of the play of the one in the many. In a phenomenal world so created, universe so created, the separative form becomes the foundation and the starting point of all its life action. Therefore, the individual Purusha, in working out its cosmic relations with the One, has in this physical world to place himself upon the form, to assume a body. It is the body that he must make his own foundation and the starting point for his development of the life and mind and spirit in the physical existence. Sri Aurobindo is paying so much attention to this because in a sense all these other philosophies that he has put aside ultimately cannot explain the evolutionary or spiritual reality of the physical. The physical is the ultimate entrapment. It is the prison out of which the soul must escape. But here he is pointing out, no, indeed, it is the choice of spirit to individualize itself completely that allows the individual, the true individual, the Purushottama, to become multiple Purushas capable of a differentiated play on this earth. So then he gives the explanation to birth. Remember, he starts this chapter by calling birth the first mystery and death the second. So this appearance suddenly something appears in matter. It also explains what he has prepared in the previous paragraph by saying that to our materialized experience, the individual just appears and disappears. It is replaced by other individuals. We see no persistence. So here, that appearance out of nowhere into a body is being explained in physical, in spiritual terms. That assumption of body we call birth. So what assumes body is the true individual. The true individual is eternal. It is the one. It is the truth as an individual. Therefore, it cannot disappear. It appears only as a appearance of something which always exists. It disappears also only as an appearance of something which always exists. That assumption we call birth, and in it only can take place here the development of self and the play of relations between the individual and the universe, universal and all on the other individuals. Leela can only take place here. Self-finding consciously as an individual can only take place here. The cosmic history can only be redeemed here. In it only can there be the growth by a progressive development of our conscious being towards a supreme recovery of unity with God and with all in God. Because in God's image we have been created. It is God's self-finding in an individual form in each individual. All the sum of what we call life in the physical world is a progress of the soul and proceeds by birth into the body, and has that for its fulcrum, its condition of action, and its condition of evolutionary persistence.
So, it seems that mind and body both have this division as its one of the most important principles, right? However, life, on the other hand, I mean, it is necessary to manifest the principles. Its existence is necessary to manifest the principles, but it is not directly related. It is subject to the division, but it is not directly related to the division principle. Is that correct?
Yes. It's actually, you see, if you look at these three principles, you find that matter is ultimately atomic. It is atomizable. In other words, whatever form it takes can and does get broken down. There is a constant tendency within matter to fragment things into particles. No form retains its coherence. Yeah, that's why he says to be, the condition of a physical immortality is to be reborn perpetually. A form begins taking place in the life principle, but forms are fluid in life. They don't have a fixed form. In mind, forms have durability. They have a much greater possibility of endurance, of remaining preserved. And these mental forms, they can also be plastic. But nevertheless, they have a greater sense of identity. Now, that differentiation of the mind into ideas or into idea forms has to become stable as a kind of totally differentiated, fragmented form. That can only happen in matter. Because mind also undergoes principle of differentiation, but it is still a kind of, one idea can have many forms. Life also, it may be fluid, but within life also there are life forms. But the real, basis of division into rigid forms is matter. So that's why he says, this play of difference has found its utmost term of the sense of division by the precipitation of the dividing mind into a form of body, not into body, into a form of body in which it becomes conscious of itself as a separate ego. In other words, to mind there may be so many kinds of bodies, but matter yields up a form of body. See, matter can be undifferentiated, but undifferentiated matter will be differentiated into forms of body by the mind. And each of these forms of body will be distinct due to the distinction of rigidity communicated by the principle of matter.
Yeah, I mean, the mind's principle is division, and it gets the object, it's objectified by the matter. But life seems to be a little different, is it not? I mean, it almost feels like it came down and became subject to the division. Yes. Its original principle was not division, like.
Yes, that is true. Mind's original principle is division. It divides, and life, and for that matter, matter also, matter's own principle is not so much division. Matter's own principle is undifferentiation. It is an amorphous mass. It is like a kind of a fragmented, sort of mass without form. Form appears in matter only due to the imposition of ideas on it by mind, and inhabitation by life gives it life.
Shall we end with the meditation?
Yes, let's.